We present the news quiz with your host, Miles Jupp.
Hello and welcome to the news quiz. We start with a cutting from the Bristol Post, read by Susan Ray.
A man in his 40s remains in hospital after suffering injuries when he was shot twice in the Jolly Roger in the early hours of Saturday.
Thanks to Tom Bland in Bristol for sending in that little bit of naughty. Now, let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first, on my right, Andy Hamilton and Susan Kalman. And opposite them, on my left, senior political correspondent at BuzzFeed, Emily Ashton and Ellis James. So, Andy, what is the only red thing that Jeremy Corbyn doesn't like?
Yeah, well, it's Jeremy Corbyn. He's been worrying me this week quite a lot. It worried me because whenever he got up and called for an end to sniping, name-calling abuse, I thought, yeah, that's my living you're talking about there. Stay off my patch, beardy. in the spirit of the newer kind of politics, I'll say he had a pretty good week at conference until possibly the last day when he said that if he became Prime Minister, he would never push the nuclear button. And that was until his shadow cabinet then said that they thought that in certain circumstances they would push his hand onto the button. I think roughly how it would work. But, I mean, if he ends up being Prime Minister, but the party have voted to keep Trident, it will be tricky because there's no point having a nuclear deterrent unless you're prepared to use that crucial element of bluff. And Jeremy Corbyn doesn't seem like the kind of... Well, I'll put it the kindest way I can. I shouldn't imagine he's very good at poker. I think it's probably a case of, you know, you got a strong hand, Jeremy? Nah. Oh, look for yourself. But, I mean, Trident, it's going to continue to be divisive because it is indefensibly expensive. But at the same time, people are worried. It's an uncertain world. Sometimes they worry that they need a deterrent. I think I might have come up with a solution, which is, I think, if the policy was that we don't have nuclear weapons, but that we pretend that we do. Seems to be a win-win for everyone.
Well, we could still have a red button, couldn't we?
Yeah, we have all of that.
Could not be attached to
it. Wouldn't be hard. We build fake missiles out of cardboard or recycled plastic or whatever, you know, nice and big, so they show up on Putin's satellite photos. Mysterious convoys going up and down. Fake the occasional accident. Fence off whales.
The BBC are always telling me to press the red button on my remote control. Is that linked in any way to this? That was just to get the extras from Strictly Come Dancing, but now I'm thinking there might be something else going on.
In fairness to him, like, I wouldn't press the nuclear button. I don't even like turning the immersion heater on. I mean, so the nuclear button is a big deal. And also, he's campaigned against it for 40 years. So it would be insane for a journalist to say, would you press the nuclear button? And for him to go, to be honest, now it's actually a possibility.
I quite fancy it, actually.
So I watched the conferences and I just... we were all waiting for Corbyn and there's been a lot of discussion about his stand-up that he did at the start of his speech, which was... I mean, it's nice, but part of me also wanted to hear some policy.
Emily, I mean, we're rank amateurs. You were there this week at the Labour Party conference. So which Labour MP looked sort of most awkward throughout the whole thing?
Well, the ones that would have felt awkward weren't there. Chuck Rumina, Tristram Hunt, Mary Cray, they all got on a train right before the speech because they did not want to be sitting in the audience with cameras trained on their faces as they clapped. Oh, well done. The funny thing was, in the evenings of this conference, you have endless parties.
Who are the really big drinkers? I mean, who behaves like... Yeah. And I'm not after tittle-tattle here, but... don't even think about naming names. But I mean, yeah. Who do you watch?
Everybody.
Think, I cannot believe you are a serving MP. You are an animal.
I couldn't name any individual, literally any MP. You
can
know,
you not remember? Because we can.
That's probably it. That's probably it.
We can do hypnotherapy if you fancy.
I mean, I think the phenomenon of Jeremy Corbyn is really interesting, but I have to say I was a little bit disappointed about how conventional the speech was. I mean, one of the first things he did was the thing that every leader does, which is attempt to define Britishness as part of their patriotism. And he came out with what they all come out with, which is, oh, we're unique, you know, we're a caring, kind nation. We don't walk past on the other side, you know. And I thought, really? I walk past the same beggars every day on Oxford Street, and tens of thousands of people do it as well. They can't all be tourists. You know, there was this kind of mythology thing, and then...
But wouldn't you have felt personally a bit demoralised if Corbyn had opened his speech by saying, by the way, Andy Hamilton doesn't give money to beggars?
No, but I just wish that...
I mean, that would have been...
Yeah.
I mean, just for him to single you out would have been unfair, obviously, but in terms of...
But, you know, there was that... And also when he... I thought he also got his definition of Britishness very out of kilter, because at one point he said British people don't have to accept what they're given. Well, that's the essence of being British. That's why that's why we don't send food back in restaurants. Yeah. You know, so if he's going to advocate making a fuss, he's going to come across as very unpatriotic.
The one thing that genuinely defines Britishness is the Great British Bake Off. There is no question. That is, if you were trying to explain what it's like to be British, that is the programme, because it's multicultural, it's full of innuendo, and people cry over pastry. And that is... In essence, what it is to be British.
It would be great if he did if he summed up Britishness in quite a bleak way. Yeah. For me, Britishness, I mean, a lot of us are quite bad in the morning. a lot of us have got quite rubbish broadband. to be honest, I hate being British. It's absolutely rubbish, just like each and every one of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
But he was told to do that because there's this whole kind of idea that he's some form of communist that hates the country and he wants to overthrow capitalism. So I don't think it's wrong that he had necessarily parts of the speech that had previously been written for Miliband in it before, because I think in political speech writing they do recycle ideas. So that's not the problem. It's just that I really did want something completely different, with and that, it wasn't actually that different.
With that, because he was accused of plagiarism, because the same political speech writer, is it Richard Heller, is that his name?
Heller,
he's offered this bit of text to every Labour leader since Neil Kinnock, and they've all turned it down. And then Corbyn sort of thought, yes, please. But then, Can't Get You Out of My Head is the most successful single of the 2000s, and that was turned down by S Club 7 and Sophie Ellis-Bextor. So, you know, I think he made quite a good...
It's a lesson that's easily overlooked.
Yeah, if he'd combined that speech with Hot Pants, the mind boggles.
But what he should have done with that passage to explain it is, you know, with his PMQs and he's asking people, please write in, you know, and I will read out your question. He should have just started his speech. This speech was sent in by Richard from London.
I'll tell you the other thing that I thought was depressingly conventional was the slogan. Because I thought if he had genuinely a new kind of politics, don't have a slogan. But he did, and he chose...
Just have a big banner up that says, well, here we all are.
But if you're going to have a slogan, I mean, he chose straight-talking, honest politics. If you're going to choose a slogan, don't choose one that will turn around and bite you in the arse, which is what that will do. Because what it means is, whenever he is evasive or disingenuous, which he'll have to be because he's Labour leader, there will be moments when he has to do that, then that will be thrown straight back in his face. He should not have had a slogan. He should have had a picture of some kittens or something like that.
What about his sort of basic skills then? I mean, what about his use of the auto cue?
There's a slight cock-up, wasn't there, because he read the words... strong message here, like it was part of his speech. So.
Jeremy was very lucky because although he read it, sort of made sense.
Yeah.
And he read it as if it meant, so he went, strong message here, didn't he? I mean, it could have been a lot worse. It could have been, you know, we must invest in young people and lean forward sincerely.
Astoundingly, these are the latest antics of Jeremy Corbyn, either the people's friend or a defrosted member of the 1950s Soviet Politburo. It all depends on what papers you read. This week, Corbyn provoked criticism from members of his own shadow cabinet after saying that he would not be prepared to use nuclear weapons, which is either a brave stand in support of peace or a craven surrender to his sinister paymasters in the Kremlin. Again, it all depends very much on which papers you read. Corbyn, the Open University 1978 Lecturer of the Year, open brackets, runner-up, delivered his first speech to Labour Party conference this week. Journalists revealed that Corbyn's speech had been copied and pasted from a speech appearing on a website, although suspicions had been aroused in the hall when he thanked the bridesmaids, read out some telegrams from people who couldn't make it, and made a tearful toast to someone called Terry and Siobhan. I'm not that keen on borrowing from other writers. In fact, I would go so far as to say that I have a dream that one day on the Red Hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. But, you know, that is just what I think. Several big-name Labour MPs missed the speech altogether, but they said they'd be able to catch up on it simply by watching an old episode of Citizen Smith. Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell also spoke to conference and set out his plans for the economy, promising that his speech would be quite boring. Not since Caligula said things might get a little fruity has a promise been so unequivocally delivered. 2 points to Andy. Susan, who was late for assembly but early to the battlefield?
This is a question about Syria, the comedy question all of us were hoping to get. So, it was the 70th UN General Assembly. Big Baz Obama turned up. Big Vlad turned up a bit later. And they were talking about a lot of things, but Syria was one of the points they were talking about. And Big Baz said he wanted a considered and tactical regime change from Assad in Syria, which essentially means they want rid of him. If your boss says they're tactically considering your position, I think that means you're fired. And so Putin and Obama actually shook hands at one point, and if you watch the video, it's an extraordinary one. It's like if you meet someone when they're coming out of the toilet and you have to shake their hand and you go... It was a very limp and very brief handshake between them. So everyone goes away thinking, that was a good party, we've done well there. The American embassy in Baghdad receives a message saying in 1 hour, Russia is going to start bombing Syria. And so what's happened since then is that Russia has started bombing Syria ostensibly to target IS groups. That's what they're saying they're doing. America has said, we don't think that's what you're doing. We think you're actually doing something different to support Assad. And Russia's answer, which I think is the most glorious political answer I've ever heard, they just went, prove it. And the UN General Assembly again proves itself, if I'm very honest, to be fairly ineffective in actually controlling anything that goes on in the world.
The photo said it all, didn't it, at the UN General Assembly of between Putin and Obama. I think when Obama walked into that room to shake Putin's hand, I think the whole thing lasted about 13 seconds. He was in, handshake, out, like the fastest ever. And when they were around this big old table with all the world leaders, Obama left Putin till last to clink his glass.
Well,
that was
the
a
first
really
time
around,
he
message.
Didn't actually clink it, did he? They had to. Putin was offering his glass like a sort of girl at a prom, you know. And Obama didn't go around that far. He had to go back for it, yeah.
And Obama must have thought, well, you know, I really showed him, yeah, didn't I? Yeah. And then an hour later, what's he done?
That's probably the moment where Putin thought, right, I'm invading Syria. But I thought it was very unlucky timing for Jeremy Corbyn that on the day he determines his pacifist position, Putin decides to go on tour with his Cold War tribute act. But the situation, I mean, it's awful. It's a terrible story. Yeah. But there's always a darkly comic moment in there somewhere. And I would love to have been a fly on the wall. It was a general, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Had to go up to the military headquarters in Baghdad, ring the doorbell, bing, bong. Vladimir Putin, he probably said to him, look, go around there, tell them we're going to... But say please. Just because we're bombing people doesn't mean we have to forget our manners. And they had to get their bomb. I mean, it's quite scary. It'll all calm down once Trump is president, obviously.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Because you used to work at or for the UN?
I worked at the UN. I worked at the United Nations in Geneva. And it's a really interesting, strange place. They sell lovely prawn rolls.
All right.
Which were delicious. But it was £8 for a rum and coke.
Ooh.
And I think that's just wrong.
Well, we've heard some shocking things tonight.
It was a weird, strange place. And I smoked a lot. And I drank a lot of gitane. I smoked a lot, drank a lot. I used to play chess with old men in the park. And they
didn't you have chess pieces?
No.
Startlingly, this story is of how Russia leapfrogged over UN General Assembly and started its own bombing campaign against Syria, targeting what it claims are IS strongholds in the country. Russia claimed it attacked IS terrorists rather than rebel-held territories, that Assad is part of the solution rather than the problem, and that polonium is a refreshing and welcome addition to any ex-KGB informer's cup of tea. An hour before the strikes began, a Russian general left his country's embassy in Baghdad, knocked on the door of the American one round the corner and said, "You'd better move your planes, we start bombing in an hour." And people say we don't talk to our neighbours anymore. 2 points to Susan. And at the end of round one, the scores are Emily and Ellis have 4, but Andy and Susan have 6. We start round two with a cutting from an article in The Times.
Leading expert Nigel Mercer has described the lack of regulation around cheap and dangerous lip injections as ridiculous. It's happening under our noses, he said.
Thanks to everyone who sent us that. Ellis, which new parenting law may be a puff piece?
I think this is about the story that the law's changed, so you can no longer... it's no longer legal to smoke in the car if you have an under 18 present. It's a £50 fine, and it now reduces the places in the UK where it's acceptable to smoke to sitting on your own toilet, out at sea, and the top of Snowdonia, but not in the little cafe. So, it's only a £50 fine. I thought it'd be more, but the police have said that they're initially going to take a non-confrontational approach, very much like their attitude to rich paedophiles in the last 3 decades. But you'd have to be an absolute lunatic to take up smoking now. You know, unless you're addicted to standing outside offices in the rain, why on earth would you take up smoking? It's ironic, I always think, because the ideal smoker nowadays is actually quite outdoorsy.
I got a bit narked about this story because for a couple of reasons. One was the police, are they allowed to cherry pick which things are serious and which aren't? I mean, it is quite serious for a kid if they're sitting every day inhaling, you know, noxious fumes. And if it's a Volkswagen, they're getting a double whammy.
Promisingly, these are the new powers the police have to issue on-the-spot £50 fines to people smoking in cars carrying children, which seems reasonable, though I'm not sure why they shouldn't put up with smoke when adults have to put up with their incessant and, I have to say, somewhat infantile babble. The police have said that they won't be strictly enforcing the ban, but will take a non-confrontational attitude, which sounds rather like Jeremy Corbyn's plans for the armed forces. I have to say, the police come in for a lot of stick on this programme, but I think they do a great job, even if, as this story makes clear, they only do it occasionally. Brilliantly, if in England you do want to smoke in a car with your children present, it has to be in an open-topped car, so unbearable people don't need to worry. Smoking is still allowed, however, in cars in Northern Ireland and Scotland, where it's considered a vital way of keeping baby warm during the winter. And summer. Emily, who's Jamaican plans for a new prison?
Well, I think I know what you've done there. Because David Cameron was in the Caribbean this week. He made a trip to the UN first in New York, and then he hot-footed it to Jamaica. The first trip, I think, by a British Prime Minister for 14 years to Jamaica. So he went there to pledge millions on building a prison so that Jamaican prisoners here can be deported. It's this very modern prison out there, because apparently they can't be deported at the moment because the prisons aren't good enough. So if they did have to leave, they would sue us because of human rights abuses.
So it's enormously expensive, but will...
I think it will make its money back because it costs so much to pay for prison here. But then also Cameron, while he was there, made a speech to Parliament and spoke about Britain's pride in abolishing the slave trade. But he dodged calls to apologise and pay reparations, which caused a bit of a row.
So he's set up a prison, but he's not apologised for slavery.
That is the case.
There is a slight sense, isn't there, that he's adding insult to injury.
Yeah. Well, he said, essentially, that we should all just move on. Because nothing makes anyone feel better more than someone telling them, let's all just move on.
He may as well have said, get over it. And also, I found this amazing. I read this week that Britain's never formally apologised. Tony Blair came the closest. He said he had deep sorrow about slavery. Now, why not? I apologise when people bump into me in the streets. Just say sorry. I mean, it's the most British thing possible to say sorry. I mean, I say sorry for stuff I haven't done. If it gives me an easy life, if he doesn't care, just cross his fingers behind his back. I mean, that's been working for primary school children for decades.
I think the problem, though, is if you apologise for something, genuinely you accept some responsibility for it. Yeah. And that's the problem.
How far would that statute of limitations go back? Because if a lot of Jamaicans are sued for compensation for slavery, could we offset that? Because the French must owe us quite a lot for the Norman invasion.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, it was slavery, you know, we were very guilty and lots of big towns, Bristol, Liverpool.
Now, look, if you're prepared to take the blame, OK, yeah. You're not that generous to people on the street, but you're sorry for what happened years ago. Bewilderingly. Oh, no, that's not a word. It's got to be a... got to start all sentences with an actual word. It's these stifling directives from upstairs. Bewilderingly, this is the visit to Jamaica of Prime Minister David Cameron, or as they call him over there, Mr. Jerk Pork. Cameron announced plans to build a new prison in Jamaica so that Jamaican citizens who commit crimes in the UK can return home to serve out their sentences. Which means the following will now be a typical conversation in this country. I say, my wife has gone to the West Indies. Jamaica? Yes, that's her country of origin. It's where she's been forcibly deported by the Home Office. And what's more, she lacks the ground to appeal using the Human Rights Act. Boom, and indeed, if you will, tish. On the plus side for Britain, there is absolutely no precedent that suggests building a detention centre on an island, forcibly deporting people to it and then not letting them return, has ever caused problems for any other nation. 2 points to Emily. Ellis, who didn't get to leave their hats on?
Right, that is students at the University of East Anglia. Student union officials at the University of East Anglia, they have banned a Mexican restaurant in Norwich city centre from handing out sombreros to students after branding the marketing stunt racist. And the general manager of Pedro's, which was the name of the restaurant, he insisted that the promotion was meant as a celebration of Mexican culture. But then I found out that he's actually called Matthew Ward, so I don't know how much he's about Mexican culture. And about once a year, I would say, a story crops up that means I am broadly in tune with the comments on the Daily Mail website. It's the most ridiculous story I've heard for a long time. I accept that the sombrero is a stereotype, Mexican stereotype, but it's not a historic tool of oppression. It's a hat. You know, I mean, by that logic, a burrito is racist.
Distastefully, this is the case of a bunch of students at the University of Life and East Anglia who were given free sombreros by a Mexican restaurant at a Freshers Week event, only to have them confiscated by student union officials on the grounds that they were racially insensitive. In my day, students got upset about tuition fees. I'm so glad they've moved on to something that really matters. Millinery. I think it wasn't racist precisely because it was a Mexican restaurant dishing out the hats. It would have been different if it was an American diner and they were giving out the hats prior to chasing the students before erecting a wall between the students and themselves. Surely the sombreros would be an essential piece of student apparel, if only to cope with the blazing sunshine and tropical heat of Norwich in October. A sombrero's not too bad. It's much more offensive to give students the impression that they'll be able to walk into a job when they graduate. Before we reveal the final scores, has anybody got a cutting they'd like to share? Andy?
This is from Tim Cole, and it is an excerpt from a visitor's guide to a place called Souk. And it says, drive through Souk on any given day, and you will see baseball and soccer games in progress, people hitting a few tennis balls and kids at the skate park.
Susan?
This is from the Richmond and Twickenham Times. It was sent in by lots of people. A Twickenham resident has tackled a rugby fan who was urinating on her drive. The Cole Park Road resident said she confronted one man who she saw urinating in her front garden. She said, I couldn't believe it. I opened the window and shouted, oi, put that penis away. In my work as a nurse, I have dealt with a lot of penises over the years, and I have no problem with them, or with rugby for that matter.
Emily.
This is from Jube Fraser, and it's from The Times. A Scottish town has been named the best place in Britain to see UFOs by the travel guide Wanderlust. Bonnybridge, just outside Falkirk, has an average of 300 sightings a year. Police have suggested alcohol could be a factor in the sightings.
Thank you. And now let's take a look at the final scores, which show that Andy and Susan have 10, but out in front, Emily and Ellis have 11. Before we leave you, here is an extract from a Milton Keynes Council letter sent in by Trevor York in Sherrington.
The way you register to vote is changing. Please provide us with the information requested on the form overleaf by the 16th of October 2015 or the 20th of November 2015, whichever is the earliest.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Andy Hamilton, Susan Kalman, Emily Ashton and Ellis James. In the chair was Miles Jupp, and the news was read by me, Susan Ray. The chair's script was written by Lucy Clark, John Hunter and James Kettle, with additional material by Sarah Campbell and Tom Wally. The producer was Richard Morris, and it was a BBC Radio comedy production.